Well, the East Lansing Film Festival debuts today. Allow me to recommend a visit to WKAR.org, where you can hear our interview with festival founder Susan Woods from earlier this week. We covered a number of the bases, a number of the real high points from the festival. And there are clips from the trailers in there as well, so you get a real taste of several of the movies that Susan is most excited about, at least, and I think are worthy of a close look. It runs a week. The East Lansing Film Festival. Go to WKAR.org. Follow the links to current state. That interview aired back on Monday. I'm Mark Bayshore. Glad you could join us here on Thursday. More than 4 years after he urged action on the issue, Governor Rick Snyder is finally preparing to sign a $1.2 billion road funding measure for Michigan. The bill that passed both the House and the Senate will raise half the money from existing general fund revenue and the other half from hikes in vehicle registration fees and in the state gas tax. The measures were approved by razor-thin margins in both chambers. Opposition from Democrats was nearly unanimous. Less than an hour ago, I spoke with a key figure in the process, Republican House Speaker Kevin Cotter. I first asked Representative Cotter what features of the measure he most likes and which he most dislikes.
Well, you know, I think it's a great plan. You know, this is something that has been many years in the making, trying to address the issue of road funding, and I couldn't be happier about the fact that we've done that. I'm proud of this plan, and I'm proud of the fact that it is a full plan. You know, we've been hearing for so long that $1.2 billion per year is considered a full plan, and so for me, I'm very happy that we did that. I think we did it in a very thoughtful way. Another part about the plan that I am very happy about, and really I think it was so key, was the fact that we not only passed the plan, but that we protected the plan going forward against inflation. And that was the biggest, you know, I would call that the fatal flaw of the 1997 plan. You know, we've been under that 97 plan for now about 18 years, and the hole was just getting deeper because of that failure to index it for inflation.
There must be something about this that you would change. What would you change if you could change one thing?
Well, you know, I mean, honestly, it's hard for me to say. I think we got it right here. You know, I mean, I think any member could probably point to some little detail and say, you know, I don't like the way that piece of it was. And it was clear that, you know, we had to all work outside of our comfort zones to some degree. But, you know, Mark, I really struggled to look at a part of it I don't like because I would point to the fact that this was the grand compromise between those that said do it all from new taxes and fees versus the other camp that was do it all with existing money. And we split it down the middle. And I think the legislative process worked very well to that end. A lot of thought went into making sure that, you know, we did this in the least painful way possible, and I really think we accomplished that.
All along, critics, mainly Democrats, complained about two features of the plan in particular, though. Let me ask you about those, because they're both still a part of the plan. One is that it doesn't identify where the general fund money will be coming from. Why isn't that possible? Why wasn't that possible?
You know, it wasn't done because it wasn't necessary, and what I mean by that was, again, going back to my point about doing this in a very thoughtful way and not doing it in a way that's going to bring about cuts, is the fact that we did it over a 5-year phase-in period. And so doing that allowed, we have projections as to the general fund growth, and doing that does not cause a shortfall in the general fund. And so, you know, that will bring about a situation where we don't have to make cuts in the fund. And so I think that, you know, that was key. But another important reason why we went with that a little bit longer phase-in period was, as I've been saying all along, I think it would be a mistake to simply, at the flip of a switch, put $1.2 billion into the current road building system, because it's going to naturally drive inefficiencies because of simple supply and demand. So here there's going to be some time for both the public sector and the private sector to respond, to be able to acquire equipment, to train employees, and make sure that we're not just increasing the cost of individual projects.
But haven't you saddled a future legislature with some really difficult decisions?
No, we haven't. If you look at the numbers in the budget, we haven't done that at all. Certainly, there could be a downturn, and we can never predict when the next downturn is coming. We have some great growth right now. That certainly could, and I acknowledge that. There could be a change, and if there is, there will have to be some prioritization. But I think that, you know, that's an important part of this plan, is the fact that we've gotten our priorities straight and said, if there is a downturn, roads have to be invested in, just like education has to be invested in, just like public safety. But it's a matter of getting our priorities straight.
We're talking with Speaker of the House of Michigan, Kevin Cotter, about the recently passed road bill that Governor road funding bill that Governor Snyder is expected to sign. I mean, if the bill included nothing but existing revenue, general fund revenue, where would you take it from?
Well, it would be painful. You know, if you look to cut, the general fund is about $10 billion. And so much of that money goes to, you know, health care assistance programs, corrections in other areas. So it would have been very, very difficult, and I acknowledge that. And so that's why we did not go that route. But there were interest, you know, in making cuts in particular areas of the budget. But at the end of the day, those interests couldn't package together the votes that were needed for passage. And I've been saying all along that there is a serious cost to inaction. And we have not acted on this now for a period of years. And as a result, the cost of repair has only gone up. And so that's why I think it was so critical that we finally acted and put forward a solution that's going to preserve the investment and improve the investment that we have on the ground.
You're touting the advantages here of a gradual phase-in, but I'm sure you're aware the second complaint is that it won't be phased in for another 6 years. Why wasn't it possible to pass something that would have taken effect sooner?
Well, with this plan, so there is not going to be a delay in getting additional money to the ground. What I mean by that is this is going to pair up very nicely with the budget that we passed in June. So the state's fiscal year started October 1, just a month ago, and in the current year budget, we put in an additional $400 million of general fund. So that right there shows you that we can prioritize the general fund while still making the largest investment we've ever made in public education, because we did that in this budget. So $400 million is in the current year budget, and then this plan only grows from there. So over the period of the years that follow, it'll ramp up to 1.2. And again, I think that's a responsible way to do it. But when you see, you know, the next construction season coming, you know, next spring, that is going to be the greatest amount of money that we've ever spent on roads.
Did you ever seriously doubt that it was possible to find $600 million in existing general fund dollars?
I did not. And actually, some of the plans that we were looking at in the House earlier on in the process would have gone even deeper into the general fund. But ultimately, this is where we landed, and I think this is a good place to be.
Your fellow Quadrant member, Senate Majority Leader Arlen Meekoff, claims the measure will help the economy. Do you agree?
I do. And I think from multiple aspects. You know, one, there's obviously going to be a lot of additional road work taking place. That's going to bring about jobs. That's going to bring about money moving in the state economy. But it's also, I think, going to have a very positive impact on the economy, because as you look at all the things that have happened in Michigan over these last 5 years and the turnaround that has come about, I think the single largest missing piece of that is roads. As we're looking to try to get businesses to grow in Michigan and trying to get other businesses to consider Michigan as a place to lay down a foundation, it's kind of hard to make that sell when our roads are in the condition that they are. So I think having roads in at least a reasonable condition, that's really a key part of the overall system, and it's really a prerequisite to economic development.
The Detroit Free Press reported that Senator Meekoff also said there could be some follow-up bills to improve the plan. Is your caucus tempted to fine-tune what was passed the other day with more legislation?
You know, there's an interest, and I think what that would be is not anything that would change, per se, what we just passed. You know, certainly not touching the funding or anything of that nature. But I think that, you know, looking at this through the lens of continuous improvement, I think we can always be mindful of ways to improve the system. So I think there would probably be an interest in looking at, you know, can we do things better? Can we be more efficient? Can we stretch these dollars further? Can we have greater oversight? Things of that nature. So I expect that that's what we'll see. I think that that's where members are at right now. But I'm not hearing any interest in changing, per se, what we've done, but maybe only improving it.
I'm trying to understand here how attitudes have evolved or changed toward road funding here. And my question for you is, how many representatives voted to approve this measure that probably would have voted no a year ago?
You know, that's a good question, and I can't give you a precise number. I simply don't know the answer to that, but there certainly are some. And I think that what has brought that about is it's just a realization of what's occurring. I mean, clearly the problem isn't going away, and I think we have all seen over time that it's getting worse. We have the worst roads that I remember in my lifetime, and maybe in a time period much longer than that. But I think it's just that. It's a realization that there are no easy answers. It's a realization that inaction is going to only make the problem worse. So I think there has been a bit of an evolution there. And, you know, I'm spending time right now and going not only to my district but to others and going to be explaining the details of this plan and explaining to people why I think we really did this in the best manner possible.
This long debate proves it can be hell coming up with this much money, more than $1 billion, even if it is for something as important as roads and bridges. Any thoughts on how we prevent falling behind like this in the future?
Well, I think a key part of this plan, and to the earlier question when you were asking about particular parts of the plan that I really liked, was the fact that we included that inflationary protection. So once this plan is fully phased in, the gasoline tax will be indexed to inflation. That doesn't increase revenue per se as far as the purchasing power of those dollars, but rather is a goal to protect the funding formula against future inflation. And so, you know, the 97 formula worked now for about, well, it didn't work, but it's been in place for 18 years. But, you know, we're not going to repeat that mistake again. And, you know, I think there will be a time in the future, maybe it's a decade, maybe it's a couple decades down the road, where we may need to look at making some tweaks to this plan simply to adjust to changes in technology. And where I'm going there is looking at what I expect is going to be an increased use of vehicles that don't run on gasoline or diesel fuel, you know, looking at plug-ins and hybrids and other things. And so those are changes that, you know, you can't legislate the perfect plan for 50 years because technology changes, but I think we've done the best job here that we could. The plan also included to that, in that vein, some changes for plug-ins and hybrids to have a little bit of an increased bump on their registration fee, because if you take a true plug-in, you know, they're not buying that gasoline at the pump and so not paying that portion of the use of the road. And so this was done in a manner to not penalize by any means, not to be punitive, but rather from an equality standpoint in saying that as user of the roads, we should all be paying our fair share.
You're just the kind of guy who would know when the governor is going to sign it. Have you heard when and where he will sign it?
You know, I haven't heard the exact details yet, but on the late evening hours after we passed this plan, Tuesday night, it was about 11 p.m., we held a joint press conference, myself, the governor, lieutenant governor, and Senate Majority Leader, and he was asked that very question. And he very appropriately noted, we've obviously got to do our due diligence and look over the bills as far as to make sure that everything is correct. But as far as the details of the bills, the governor stated that he's ready to sign them tonight, and he held up a pen. So I think we've had a pretty clear signal from the governor that he intends to sign this package. And I would expect we'll see that happening fairly soon. I know this has been a priority for the governor, and it's one that we're excited to get across the line.
Michigan House Speaker Kevin Cotter is our guest here on WKAR's Current State. It must seem like you've got a lot more time on your hands now these days, or at least it would seem that way to me. Are you going to be able to focus a lot more time on you must have more time in looking ahead to focus on other issues.
You know, it only seems as though there would be now this void
exactly.
My calendar, but I can tell you that void is already filled. I'm going to continue working. My caucus members and colleagues are going to continue working just as hard as we have been, because there are other issues. I think road funding, while we can work on many issues at any given time, when you have a large issue like road funding and all the attention is on it, that really, you know, it detracts from other major issues, and it kind of acts as a dam, and these other major issues pile up behind it. And, you know, there are others that are right behind it that are going to fill that void very quickly. Right now, our Energy Committee is reviewing some changes to energy policy in this state. That's a big one. That's a big one that we need to get done, so that'll help fill that void. There are other issues out there, such as, you know, the situation with Detroit Public Schools.
Yeah.
So I certainly won't have any free time. It'll just be focused on the next big issue.
Kevin Cotter is the Republican Speaker of the Michigan House. We've been talking about Michigan's new road funding measure. Thank you, sir. Appreciate your time.
Thank you so much, Mark. I enjoyed it.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR, also every weekday at noon on AM 870 WKAR. Have you ever met a Francophile, someone enamored of all things French? Well, chances are they'd be interested in this, a French immersion school in Lansing that allows participants to explore the language and the culture of France. Gaël Cassin-Ross is the founder of the school. It's called Au Petit Soin. And producer Katie Cook went to find out more about the school. She joins me now. So, Katie, what did you find most interesting about this school?
I think it's so interesting that Gaël never had any plans to teach French. She actually has a PhD in molecular biology, and she moved to Lansing from France for a research position at MSU.
So what happened?
Well, it all started after she had her son, Sagan.
I would only speak in French to my baby, and people overheard me speaking in French, and they asked me if I would teach to their children. And you know, first time you are like, ha, ha, ha. Second time you are like, yeah, sure. Third time you start thinking, oh, maybe there is something. Maybe actually all those people are telling me that there is a need in Lansing for teaching in an immersive way French to babies and toddlers. So first I started, and it was just for 0 and 4 years old kids. And I just started to get demand for older kids and people being very insistent, saying, no, I swear, if you start creating a program, I will be there, I will sign on.
Tu aimes le soleil? Compte jusqu'à 10.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
Très bien!
So where did you start in figuring out how to teach the kids?
So, of course, I'm a PhD in science, and I'm used to work with students. So, you know, it's a completely different process. So I double-guessed myself a lot. So I start reading, and people started to tell me, you know, I didn't go to school to teach English to my baby. We just want you to do what you are already doing with Sagan, but with our kids. I still took some time off to read techniques, learning about our immersion work, the mistake I shouldn't do. And I started in parallel a program for teaching French as a foreign language, just to make sure, you know, I was on top of things and I was just, you know, I knew what I was doing. I think it was very important. I wanted to have an expertise. I think I really enjoy doing it. And I think people can see it, and they can see I put really all my heart in doing it, and I really try to be creative and to be at the level of my student, regardless their age.
Why do parents in Lansing want their children to learn French?
That's a very good question. I ask that question many times. And when I ask them, they keep telling me that it's sophisticated. And I'm like, there is apparently something about the French culture. It's chic and sophisticated. It's come with a certain prestige. People want to learn French so badly because they are very, very interested in the culture. If you ask around you, many people dream about going to Europe, and especially to Paris. People have something with Paris.
Paris, c'était la gaieté Paris, c'était la douceur aussi, c'était notre tendresse.
I'm speaking with Gaël Cassin-Ross, who moved to Lansing from Paris and has started a French immersion school here. You don't speak any English to the children in your classes. How come?
No, I don't. I don't even speak English to their parents once we pass the door of the classroom. I want them to not translate. I want them to learn French by just associating to an action a different way of saying it. I really want them to look at, let's say, the action I'm eating and not thinking, oh, how can I translate that? But just have, in the, at the same time coming in their brain, I'm eating, je mange. And to do that, I need them to almost forget they can speak English and have like an empty brain and let's speak French. I try to make it very interactive and playful. We really play. We work hard, don't get me wrong, it's not all about ha 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 laughter, but I want them to be relaxed enough to accept to play the game of trying. And they do. They do. So we work on presentation right now. So how do you say your name? How old you are? If you have a good day, are you asked to someone? Did you have a good day today? You know? How do you answer to all those questions like a normal conversation? And every other week we add questions and we build on it. And so we have a first game where we use a ball and they would basically, when they have the balls, I know it's their turn to answer to whatever question was asked and to ask a different question to someone in the audience.
Quel âge as-tu?
Oh, j'ai 32 ans. Comment ça va, Amy?
Ça va bien.
Oui, bravo!
What are your goals for Au Petit Soir, the school?
It's, you know, in the reality, we need to think about how Au Petit Soir was born. Because people push me to start Au Petit Soir. Why do I have a space today? Because people dream about having a library and be able to be immersed more than just during the class. Did I plan on that? No. I love a good challenge and I'm giving everything I have to make that work and make happen everything my student and the parents of my student want. But when I picture Au Petit Soin, I would love a space where people can just be fully immersed in the French culture. I imagine someone entering in the space and having some French music playing depending on the age of people. Lullabies, or maybe more music I like. I love Edith Piaf, I love Brel, I love Gainsbourg. I mean, it's a list of people I like. I have a playlist ready to go.
Au premier temps de la valse.
So I imagine people entering in a space and almost traveling just by stepping in that space. I want that space to be a safe place for people to come after maybe a difficult day and they need to relax, you know, and they need to tune out.
Paris qui mesure notre émoi.
What can people in Lansing do to support this cultural center, this school?
So what I'm trying to do first is to have a free access to the center, to, I don't know, if you want to relax and just sit in a comfortable living room, have a coffee and listening to French music and read French press and French books, that's a place to come. To do so, I need help from the community. So I started an Indiegogo campaign for that, to get funds, but I really want the space to be accessible to everybody, a little like you would go to the East Lansing Library or to the CADL.
The two girls you heard in one of the classes earlier were Addie and Emmy, who are 9 and 8 years old. After class, I talked with their mom, Valerie, about her interest in French lessons for her kids.
Why were you seeking out French specifically?
Well, our son decided to take French this year. He's a freshman in high school. Both my husband and I took German, and so we don't know any French. And so I just thought it would be neat for us to try a different language, to try something new. I think the idea of French is kind of exciting, too, just learning a new language and kind of decoding what other people are saying in different countries.
How do you think a French cultural center would be received here in Lansing?
I think it could really add something to the community, and certainly kids like my son who's learning at school, it would give him another place to come and maybe participate in a book group or have a library where he could check out French books or have a native speaker to speak to when he's not just at school with his teacher. I think anytime you can bring new culture and language into a community, you're doing great things for that community.
And then I asked the girls what they thought about French.
How is it different from English, Emmy?
Well, it's a different language and you speak very differently with kind of a different accent.
Au revoir, Addie.
Addie, what is it like to learn French?
It's difficult at the beginning, but it is getting easier kind of step by step. So, like, it's fun.
For Current State, I'm Katie Cook.
And coming up on Current State, healthcare providers say there's been a big spike in the number of minors using electronic cigarettes. The Ingham County Health Department wants to require e-cigarette vendors to obtain a tobacco license and to refuse sales to those under 18. We talked to Ingham County Health Officer Linda Vail about the proposal, which could go before the County Commission next week. Plus, we'll get a preview of the Lansing Symphony Orchestra's upcoming concert, which features an all-American cast of composers. Stay tuned. Man and the Frog there, local guys performing Help Me on a Live Music Friday from earlier in the year here in Studio S. Tomorrow, we welcome veteran local jazz singer Betty Baxter. The Jazz Alliance of Mid-Michigan is honoring her at their 7th annual tribute concert this Sunday in Old Town Lansing. Hope you can join us for that. Betty Baxter tomorrow live here in Studio S. Current State here on WKAR, electronic cigarettes have been around barely a decade, but their popularity is exploding. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention report that in 2014, some 2.5 million middle and high school students had tried e-cigarettes. That's triple the number of teens documented in 2013. Michigan is one of only two states, plus the District of Columbia, which does not ban the sale of e-cigarettes to minors. The other state is Pennsylvania, though the city of Philadelphia has passed its own ordinance banning e-cigarette sales to minors. The Ingham County Board of Health is proposing a new regulation that would license e-cigarette vendors and forbid them from selling to minors. Joining us to talk about the proposal, Ingham County Health Officer Linda Vail. Welcome back, Linda.
Thank you, Mark.
What is actually in an electronic cigarette?
Well, electronic cigarettes are typically a nicotine is, you know, the substance that they're trying to get, you know, into the body in mm-hmm. order, you know, that's the goal is to get the nicotine. It's delivered through, you know, the vapor is created out of mostly glycerin and propylene glycol.
So it's not smoke as in a conventional cigarette?
No, it's not. It's a vapor.
Do we know whether the vapor harms the lungs as much as a conventional cigarette does?
Well, we've had e-cigarettes in the United States since about 2007, and so the science is really just building around the harmful or potential harmful effects of what's in the vapor. Mm. Is it as harmful as what's in a cigarette? Probably not. Is there harm? The evidence is building that there is.
Well, you're still ingesting an addictive substance.
That's well, in terms of the nicotine,
bottom line,
true, right.
And then you may be doing additional damage to the lungs with the vapor, even though you're not burning anything.
Correct.
Okay.
Glycerin and polyethylene glycol probably not really belonging in your lungs.
Yeah. How are e-cigarette vendors currently licensed here in Michigan? What are the rules for selling these?
There are no rules for selling e-cigarettes. E-cigarettes, e-cigars, vaping devices, those sorts of things, there are no regulations.
There are e-cigars?
Yes, there are.
I was not aware of that. Explain this proposed regulation, then, that you're placing in front of the Ingham County Commissioners. What would it do?
It simply would take all of these various devices that electronically deliver nicotine to the body through these vapors and prohibit the sales to minors. So while we're still kind of waiting for the science to build on, you know, whether or not there's any strong evidence about whether these vapors put things in the air that would suggest that we have some sort of a secondhand smoke or vapor type issue, you know, that's all building. But in the meantime, what we do know is that nicotine is addictive, that nicotine is toxic, and really quite poisonous, even lethal, to children in fairly small quantities. So a quarter teaspoon of nicotine can kill a small child. And these vaping devices are, you know, they're selling cartridges or vials of nicotine, you know, along with them. So you've got some pretty readily available, very toxic substances. Mm. Also the addiction, you know, for adults, a lot of times they're stepping down from smoking a cigarette to smoking a e-smoking device.
Mm-hmm.
Simply minors, you know, teens, are probably just entering into it via an e-cigarette device. So we look at that as a gateway, too, to potentially smoking. So the addictive properties of the nicotine is still very much there. And
sure.
It's going to be a very hard habit to break.
How easy is it for minors to buy e-cigarettes in Ingham County?
Because we don't regulate it at this point, we don't know. We do know there was a University of Michigan study, the one that you quoted in 2014, that shows about 17% of our 12th graders have reported using e-cigarette devices. So they're getting them somewhere. 17% is a pretty high number when you consider that our overall smoking rate in the county is less than 20%. And you know that that number is rapidly growing in the teens. So we're soon going to have a population of teenagers that are smoking e-cigarettes at a rate that's higher than our overall smoking rate in the state.
Hmm.
If this trend continues, which we have no reason to believe that it won't. So how much we know what's going on. There are, I will tell you, a lot of vendors that just out of the sake of feeling like it's the wrong thing to do already, they will not sell to minors. Mm. They don't have to not sell to minors, but some do.
We're talking about a proposal by the Ingham County Board of Health that would license electronic cigarette vendors in the county and prohibit them from selling e-cigarettes to minors. Michigan is one of only two states, plus the District of Columbia, that does not have such a ban. Our guest today is Linda Vale, the Ingham County Health Officer. As we said in the introduction, Michigan is just one of those two states. Are there people saying that this is a delay? What have the other 48 states accomplished that is arguably eluding us here in Michigan?
Well, honestly, the trend of regulating these has grown rapidly. Last year, there were, I believe, 11 states that were still not regulating it. So states are coming on board very quickly. The state of Michigan did have a proposal that the governor vetoed. So there was something in front of the legislature that went to the governor that would have banned the sale of e-cigarettes to minors. Honestly, the governor didn't think it was strong enough. And so he vetoed it, really.
That was the reason.
In favor of some stronger legislation.
You've had two public hearings on the proposal. The first was about 2 weeks ago, but the second one was just last night. What are you hearing at these events? What concerns are people voicing?
Really, in general, we're hearing a lot of support. The vendors showed up. A lot of the vendors showed up, mostly the ones that sell the vaping products and don't tend to sell tobacco in their shops, and were very supportive of the fact that they didn't think their product should be being sold to minors. A lot of them said that by choice they don't sell to minors as it is already, but nothing does prohibit that. There were some concerns about some, you know, language. There were some concerns about whether or not we were going to be stringent about licensing in order to create fewer, quote, vape shops in the community, and that's not where we're going with this. So it simply is a way to protect our children from basically starting a habit that is going to be a very hard habit to break, and from being exposed to things that are not really appropriate for them to be exposed to. You know, when you look at the over-the-counter device, you know, products like nicotine gum and patches and those sorts of things mm-hmm. that are sold in order to quit smoking, those are prohibited. You know, you can't sell those to minors, but we can sell e-cigarettes to minors. So all kinds of things say that we keep our children away from things, you know, harmful, alcohol, cigarettes, tobacco. We use car seats. We have seat belt laws, et cetera. That's all to protect our children until they are of age to be making decisions for themselves.
How many vape shops are there in Ingham County? Do you happen to know that?
Wow, I don't have a number okay. of how many vape shops there are in Ingham County. They're not in my mind not a lot, but you know what does a lot mean? So,
were the hearings attended by a lot of vape shop owners though, or was there a broader mix of stakeholders here?
The first meeting was really largely attended by folks who are in the vape shop industry, vape shop owners, vape shop folks. So we did have somebody from the American Heart Association there in support of us. We had somebody from the Prevention Council last night there supporting us. I have a letter on file from the Michigan State University physician, Dr. Weissmantle, in support of what we're doing. So we are also getting a lot of support. And the vape shop folks showed up there with some concerns, but also in the end, really very supportive of the fact that these things are not appropriate for children and that restricting sales to minors is a good thing.
And I'm learning that the vape shop owners have said that they're unhappy with the use of the term electronic smoking devices, and they say this isn't smoking because it's not tobacco.
Correct, or because it's not being lit on, you know, it's a battery device.
Right,
so, yeah,
right.
They express some concern over the use of e-smoking device, and also the regulation was going to issue them a tobacco retailer license, so being identified as a tobacco retailer was also a concern. They're certainly trying to separate or distance themselves from being tobacco or being part of the tobacco industry, and I'm not here to debate that. As I told them, what I'm here for is to protect children from things that we should appropriately be protecting them from.
Can private businesses, bars, restaurants, and the like enact their own smoke-free policies or vape-free policies at their discretion?
They absolutely can. But by state law, you can go into a bar or a restaurant or whatever and use an e-smoking device. You can't smoke cigarettes in there. That's now prohibited under the law that went
right.
into effect in 2010. So no, but you do see some owners, some facilities, certainly some public facilities, hospitals, things like that, that prohibit the use of those as well as cigarettes.
We're talking about a proposal by the Ingham County Board of Health that would license electronic cigarette vendors in the county and prohibit them from selling e-cigarettes to minors. Michigan's one of only two states, plus the District of Columbia, that does not have such a ban. Our guest today is Linda Vail, the Ingham County Health Officer. Talk to us about compliance checks. I mean, that's a function your department undertakes from time to time. Would they apply here if this became law? How would that work?
Absolutely. We would implement it just as we do our tobacco regulation that we do in the county. So compliance checks are done with what we use is what we refer to them as teen decoys. So our staff, we have a staff person that's responsible for compliance checking with this ordinance, and she goes out with teens who go into retailers to attempt to make a purchase. If they are successful at that, we follow up with issuing a violation notice.
Realistically, Linda, do you think a new ordinance will keep e-cigarettes out of kids' hands?
Oh, of course I do. I wouldn't be doing it if I didn't think it was going to be effective. So I don't think it will. I mean, keep it out of kids' hands? No. Do we keep cigarettes out of kids' hands completely? No, we don't. Do we keep alcohol out of kids' hands completely? No, we don't. But these regulations have shown to decrease the use. So we went from 17-18% of teens using cigarettes in the county many years ago before we had a tobacco regulation. You know, now we're far below that. So it is obviously never going to be totally effective. People find their way to get on hands on things that are not legal for them to get their hands on, but it is very effective in reducing the rates.
Well, we'll keep an eye on it. It goes to the Ingham County Board of Commissioners. While we're here, I want to switch gears very briefly and just ask you what kind of flu season you're anticipating here in Ingham County.
Well, it's hard to anticipate flu season always. What we're seeing right now is very low to, I mean, there's really not a lot of flu activity going on. Most of it is, you know, we got our H3N2 and our H1N1 flus going on. Most of what's being seen in the nation right now is the old H3N2 flu. So we aren't seeing a really severe season coming upon us right now. But one, you know, you never know, because flu season kind of peaks in January, February, and we kind of learn as we go every flu season.
Linda Vale is the health officer for Ingham County. We've been talking about a proposed regulation coming up before the Ingham County Commission to license electronic cigarette vendors. Linda, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Mark.
This is Current State. You're listening to 90.5 WKAR. The Lansing Symphony Orchestra's next Masterworks concert is this weekend at Wharton Center. Current State's Melissa Benmark is here with more. Hey there.
Hey, this is an All-American Composers program. Actually, they're All-American composers that start with B also. But there's several Michigan connections with this, including a saxophone quartet with roots at MSU. And I talked to conductor Timothy Muffet about the concert and asked him why he put this particular set of pieces together on the program.
There are two elements that went into this program. One was I wanted to find a venue for this extraordinary concerto grosso for four saxophones by William Bolcom. In a way, that was the, the foundation of the program. It's an exceptional work, but obviously an extraordinary work. It's a concerto for four saxophones by an American composer who lives here in Michigan.
There are no other, I assume,
not that I know
for
of.
Four saxophones.
There may be, but I don't know of them. Certainly not by a composer of the esteem of William Bolcom. And then there's another work that I really wanted to share with our audience, and I wanted the Lansing Symphony to play, and that's the Barber First Symphony. So the Bolcom work is American music through and through. And so I thought that it would work nicely. I thought there was a way to work the Barber First Symphony and the Bolcom into the same program. So along with the Barber, this seemed like a great opportunity to share also the Barber's Adagio for Strings, which is one of, for many people, their favorite piece of music, rightfully so. So the first half of the program is all Barber. It'll open with the Adagio for Strings, and then we'll go on to the First Symphony. And then after intermission, we'll launch into this incredible experience of the concerto, which takes us into a zone of American music that could really only be followed by Leonard Bernstein.
On the Town episodes are classic. Talk about your saxophone soloists.
Oh, my gosh. Well, East Lansing, Michigan is the epicenter of the saxophone in North America, really.
You're not making this up.
No, that's not. I don't believe that's hyperbole at all. Most of the great saxophonists I've heard in this country have had one or two degrees of separation from Jim Forger. And it's a perfect storm in many ways. We have William Bolcom, who lives right here in Michigan. He lives in Ann Arbor. We have, as I mentioned, this extraordinary school of saxophone playing that emanates from Jim Forger. Jim Forger is playing in the quartet, and the other three are students of his, who are now in various positions across the country. one of whom is also on the faculty here, Joe Luloff, teaching at Michigan State, Griffin Campbell, teaching at Louisiana State University, Chris Greveston, teaching at Arizona State University. Four extraordinary musicians, all from the same concept of playing. And here we are at the place where this relationship between these four men began, and again bringing it back to a Michigan composer, a composer living here. It's a work that was brought to my attention by Jim Forger, and on the first hearing I thought, my gosh, this is brilliant. If one imagines a work for four solo saxophones, I think that comes with a sort of a preconceived idea of what it might be, and this work meets all those expectations in the best possible way, and then some. It explores every facet of saxophone playing, and in the most exciting and joyous and beautiful and fun way imaginable. This work will bring down the house.
The Barber Adagio for strings, you know, with the exception of Carmina Burana, maybe one of the most used pieces of classical music in film. So people, you know, potentially kind of going in already with some images and ideas about it. And probably more people are familiar with the Adagio than with the Barber Symphony No. 1. I'm not quite sure how to phrase this, but I guess tell us how you think. How do you want people to think about these two pieces of music coming into the concert? How do you want them to listen to them?
Right. Well, of course, anytime we hear a work live, that is a whole new context from hearing it as background music in a movie, as The Barber has been used, and probably many people will recognize it from that. So just the experience of sitting down and embracing this work in a live performance with human beings playing it for you right there on the spot, I think will really set the paradigm in an appropriate way. I know that the first symphony of Barber is slightly off the beaten path for many listeners, and so I felt like it was good to share with them some Barber that they knew intimately, and then the first symphony, which is a very listenable piece. There's nothing, it's a 20th century romantic work, the first symphony, full of incredible drama and beautiful melodies as only Barber could write. But I thought it might be interesting for our listeners to go from the super familiarity of the Adagio for strings into perhaps a piece that is new for them or somewhat unfamiliar.
Timothy Muffet, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
For Current State, I'm Melissa Benmark.
And WKAR's Jody Knoll will be hosting the preview conversation before the concert at 7:15 in the Jackson National Lounge. His guest will be James Forger, one of the saxophone soloists on the program and dean of the MSU College of Music. And that's our show for today. Coming up Friday on Current State, General Motors UAW workers have been voting on a proposed new contract with the automaker. We could learn the results by tomorrow. We'll get an update and explore what the pact could mean with Cranes Automotive's GM beat writer Mike Colias. Plus, in the history of aviation, Charles Lindbergh and Amelia Earhart get a lot of the glory as pioneering pilots, but this year, as you're getting ready to ship your holiday gifts to loved ones far away, take a minute to think about a hometown hero. Philip Parmalee grew up in St. John's, was trained by Orville Wright, and made the very first air cargo flight in history. Current State's Kevin Lavery brings you his story tomorrow. Hope you can join us on Friday. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. April Van Buren directed our show today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, Melissa Benmark, Kevin Lavery, Jamie Paisley, Katie Cook, and Drew Hill. We're a podcast as well as a broadcast. Check us out on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcast to have the latest episode delivered to your smartphone. You can also connect with us on social media on Twitter at KAR Current State, on Facebook at Current State from WKAR. Hope to see you on Live Music Friday with Betty Baxter live in Studio S tomorrow. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.